Welcome back to another episode of Soomsec's podcast series, Sea Control Asia Pacific. I'm your host, Natalie Zambi. Before we get stuck into today's podcast about Indian Ocean maritime security, we'll be back after this short break.
Soomsec brings you the best content on maritime security, technology, history, and international affairs. And, like the United States, Soomsec is, and always will be, free. Sign up to become a member today by visiting www.cimsec.org/about/membership, which gets you daily emails of our articles and a WordPress account that sends your own writings directly to our editorial staff. However, admin, special projects, software, events, and prizes do cost money. There is a new option to make a voluntary monthly donation at the bottom of every Soomsec article. No matter how you choose to support us, those who volunteer for leadership, our amazing content producers, our readers, our listeners, our conference planners and attendees, and our financial benefactors, we are incredibly grateful. Remember, Sea Control is more than just a podcast, and Soomsec is more than just a website. We are a vibrant community built on a passion for discovery and discussion. Sign up, write, donate, comment, or even leave 5 stars on our iTunes page. Join us today.
Could we see the next major flashpoint in the Indian Ocean? How is India's Modi government reacting to China's growing interest in its strategic backyard? What role could India play in maritime disputes in the South China Sea? In my last episode, DC-based analysts Nilanthi Samaranayake and Scott Cheney-Peters grappled with some of these questions. And in this episode, we're bringing you an Indian and Australian perspective on the Indian Ocean. Joining me are Dashana Barua, Junior Fellow at the Observer Research Foundation in New Delhi, and David Lang, Analyst and Editor of The Strategist at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute in Canberra. Thank you both very much for joining me.
Thanks, Natalie.
Thank you. Happy to join.
All right, let's kick off with the first question. I just wanted to ask, David, perhaps I'll start with you, to just outline some of the major developments in the Indian Ocean region and why we should pay attention to them.
Sure, Nat. Well, China's really the major development in the Indian Ocean region. Over the past few years, we've really seen a growing Chinese role and interest in playing a greater role in the Indian Ocean. But we're really unsure, like the Western Pacific, we're unsure if China's going to play by the established rules-based order that has really underwritten prosperity in the region and allowed a lot of nations to rise. So India really understands this challenge and is now looking more to China as its long-term security threat rather than traditionally it's looked to Pakistan. One major development has really come with the election of Narendra Modi to be India's Prime Minister. And in March, we saw his most significant outreach to the Indian Ocean region. He took a trip where he stopped by the Seychelles, the Mauritius, and Sri Lanka. And it was significant for a number of reasons, not least of all the period of time that elapsed between a visit from an Indian head of state. In the Seychelles, it had been 34 years. In Sri Lanka, it had been 28 years. So Modi really took this opportunity to step forward and present India as a net security provider in the region. He's really trying to create and cultivate a greater Indian role. And so whether that comes in the form of maritime capacity building, Nilanthi spoke last week about the patrol boats. There's also surveillance radars that India are participating in. And then also maritime domain awareness through ocean mapping and other activities. Civilian activities are also a focus of the Modi government. He's extended lines of credit for infrastructure projects in both Mauritius and in Sri Lanka to the tune of many hundreds of millions of dollars. And I think this has all really been assisted by not only Modi's election, but by a changing of the guard in Sri Lanka particularly. The defeat of the Rajapaksa government really provided an opportunity for Modi to lean forward and develop the Indian relationship with Sri Lanka. And indeed, the new leader in Sri Lanka, Sirisena, has pledged that he will correct and reorient Sri Lanka from a Chinese tilt to more of an Indian role.
Darshan, I was just wondering if you wanted to add anything about that and perhaps develop a little bit of the idea of China's maritime Silk Road as well.
Yes, David has really captured everything well, and I really think what he talked about, the political change in Sri Lanka, I think that's a really important development for us. And also the Chinese infrastructure investments in the Indian Ocean littoral countries is a very big development. You know, boosting connectivity, it's something that the region needs, but it's also something that India is a bit concerned about. Because I'm not saying that you look at everything that China does with suspicion, but you cannot also ignore that these are new developments in the current security order, and it is bound to bring some changes. And you know, we don't know how it's going to, where it's going to lead. The concern in India is because of the uncertainty that these projects have, the scope of these activities as far as strategic implications are concerned. And it may not be strategically driven right now, but you never know. 5 years down the line, developments may favor China, prompting them to look at the situation differently. So, yeah, these are developments that I think that's a bit of a worry for India, and that should be taken into concern.
And I'll just add on to that, Natalie. It's India's posture is now motivated by China, and beyond the economic and infrastructure developments, we're seeing China's military push into the Indian Ocean region, from the selling of submarines to Pakistan, and then more recently patrols of Chinese naval submarines, both at the end of last year and then a few weeks ago. This is all really making India quite nervous about what's to come with China's presence in the Indian Ocean. And the background really is the recent comments from China saying that India shouldn't consider the Indian Ocean as its backyard.
Yes.
And so really India is quite nervous about this, and you see it in their joint statements with these Indian Ocean countries. There was a particular focus on maintaining peace, stability, and prosperity in the Indian Ocean region, and that's in regard to the China challenge.
Sure, sure. Darshan, I'd like to ask if you can expand perhaps on some of the strategic priorities. David talked about peace and stability. What are India's other strategic priorities? And, you know, with the election of Narendra Modi, how has that changed? What are actually his, what's his impact on the strategic outlook?
Sure. The Indian Ocean, for the Indian Navy, the Indian Ocean has always been a primary area of interest. And currently, it appears like India is willing to play more of a security role in the evolving Indo-Pacific security architecture. For now, what's important for India is to maintain its current role as a key actor in the region and to engage with other powers in the region to secure the slots. I think India is really aware of the fact that the Chinese are coming in a big way. And what is interesting here is that now we can see the Sino-Indian competition expanding from the Himalayan borders, which has been traditional, to the maritime domain. And it is a new development. This is an area where Indian and Chinese interests have not converged in the past, so to say. So it's how to see how do we manage the strategic interests of these two rising powers. And I mean, India has a good, strong foothold in the Indian Ocean, and China is trying to establish one. So I guess both nations are bound to inch upon each other's interests. And we, India, at this point, can't really compete with China in the economic front. So strategically, specifically within Chinese activities, within Indian neighborhoods, say with Bangladesh, Pakistan, Sri Lanka, Maldives, that's what concerns us, what's going on there. Narendra Modi has taken India's focus back to the maritime domain with a lot of renewed vigor. There is New Delhi is expressing some sort of a willingness to play more of a role. The LOCUST policy is now its active policy. I think what we signed with the US, the joint statement on the Asia Pacific and the Indian Ocean region, is a significant development. And India is now interested in expanding its engagements at a multilateral level, especially in the maritime domain with the key powers. Japan is joining Malabar this year. Then we're starting our first bilateral exercise with Australia. We're looking to engage more with Japan, even with the Southeast Asian countries. Indonesia, we're looking out to Indonesia as well. So it's more of like we're trying to create some sort of a network and maintain peace and security, which we think might be challenged at the moment. So there is movement, there are things are happening. And I think Narendra Modi is building a momentum to play that security role that Indian analysts talk so often about.
Dashana, you mentioned just now that China and India are trying to gain a foothold in the Indian Ocean region and that India can't compete with China economically. I was wondering if there's potential for us to see China's presence in the Indian Ocean as a welcome development. Dashana, I might ask you to start on that and then David.
Right. No one can actually stop Chinese presence in the Indian Ocean. I mean, if and when a navy gets stronger and bigger, it will venture out. And that appears to be what the Chinese are trying to do. And China has been present in the Indian Ocean through its anti-piracy efforts, and the mission is only increasing. For India, the concern is regarding what it does, what are the strategic implications of Chinese presence, because even apart from the anti-piracy missions, the way China is coming into the Indian Ocean right now is only through economic investments in terms of infrastructure building and boosting regional connectivity. So it's got a bunch of infrastructure projects lining the Indian Ocean littorals, and really know what are the intention, and that gels well with the Maritime Silk Road that China has proposed. And China's presence is welcome in the multipolar world, and if China hopes to be a great power, it will have to take up some of the responsibility. But the concern is the uncertainty that is attached to these activities, that we don't know what's going to happen, and also China's not doing very well with the maritime disputes in the South China Sea. So right now, China and maritime kind of sounds a bit of trouble to everybody, I suppose. And there is some sort of concern and nervousness about a new actor joining the region, which is the Indian Ocean. So if you look at the white paper, recently released Chinese white paper, if that is an indication, they have really emphasized on offshore water defense and open seas protection. I mean, it is legitimate for China to try and protect its slots in the Indian Ocean because the majority of their trade, and specifically oil, flows through that area. But I don't know how that is going to inch bond or how much of it is going to play out and inch bond India's strategic interest in the region.
I see. David, what's the view from Canberra?
I don't think there's really any other option but to welcome China's presence in the Indian Ocean, but it sort of has the same caveat attached to it as China's rise more broadly, and particularly in the West Pacific. That is, we have an existing rules-based order. Come and play ball with us. Don't challenge it. We're not trying to remake the order that has served us all so well. But the Indian Ocean region is particularly very different from the Western Pacific with regard to its security architecture. And I know Nilanthi went through this in detail with regard to the Indian Ocean Rim Association and the Indian Ocean Naval Symposium in the last edition of Sea Patrol. So I won't go into it beyond making the point that the regional security architecture in the Indian Ocean region is grossly underdeveloped. And both of those bodies, while they have a lot of potential, they really need more work on their agendas to bring it into a more productive and fruitful alignment. The institutional and work arrangements of both groups need to be strengthened, and we really need to lean forward. Leaders like Australia, India, Indonesia, these sort of large maritime actors in the Indian Ocean region, really need to lean forward to develop the regional security architecture. One other point I'd make is, Dashana just touched on it then, is China's actions in the Gulf of Aden with regard to its piracy activities. Its counter-piracy patrols have been reported to have provided escort services for many thousands of ships. Half of them might be Chinese, but it's certainly played by the rules and the international maritime norms and laws like freedom of navigation. So we know that China understands these global maritime expectations, and that really provides a useful demonstration so that when we come to the Asia Pacific and the sort of challenges we're seeing in the East China Sea and the South China Sea, we can talk to China about the sort of behaviours that they are showing us in the Gulf of Aden, and say, well, why don't we play by those same rules in the Western Pacific?
Sure, and we'll come back to the South China Sea a little bit. I'd like to return to something that Dashana was talking about earlier in terms of India showing up its relationships with the United States, with Australia, with Japan, Indonesia, other Southeast Asian states. Dushan, I would like to start with you. I would just like to get your thoughts on the developments in particular in the Indian-American relationship. What's your comment on there, and how does that help India further its goals?
Sure. I think India's relationship with all the three countries that you just mentioned, US, Japan, Australia, is really improving. The Narendra Modi, the Prime Minister, has been in office for a little more than a year now, and he's already visited all the three nations in an effort to strengthen a bilateral relationship. US, too, is very keen on to see India playing more of a role, and America has gone as far as to say that India is the linchpin for the pivot or the rebalance. Japan is again keen on elevating Indo-Japanese ties and would like to see more of a Indian presence, not just in the Indian Ocean, but also in the Asia-Pacific, Western Pacific. Australia is really keen. Australian Foreign Minister Julie Bishop was here, and she made a speech at ORF, and she was here in April, and she was really clear that India and Australia, we have a common vision in upholding a rules-based security order in the Indian Ocean, and that, that India and Australia should work together on it. And I think what she said was really, she articulated the entire struggle right now very well when she said that that the Indo-Pacific era is not about managing one power, but it's about managing multiple powers in one region. And I think that's really true because there's so many powers. Like David just said, what's happening in the Western Pacific is much different than what's happening in the Indian Ocean. And it's two different scenarios. And in the Indian Ocean, there are so many powers that it's not going to be easy for one power to come in and change the dynamics, but it's equally important for the powers to maintain the rules-based order that's existing at the moment. And in that sense, India wants to engage with Australia, India wants to engage with the US, India wants to engage with Japan and create a network, create a multilateral engagement whereby just by doing exercises, we're engaging more, we're just holding up the existing international norms and rules that are already there. And it goes well with what India wants to do right now, and India wants to try and play a role in the evolving architecture that's coming up. So I guess it will improve. I mean, there is much more scope for things are happening, and I think there is much more scope for development with these countries, because I guess somewhere India is also a bit concerned about China somewhere, even if it's the Indian Ocean. We do keep China in mind in most of our decisions, and it should not appear like everything is aimed at China. So things will happen, but I guess it's going to take a bit of time, and there is much more scope for improvement with these countries.
Sure. David, I'd like you to pick up where sort of Dushana has dropped a couple of references to Australia's role. Could you expand a little bit on the developments in the Australia-India relationship and the significance of those developments, please?
Certainly. The Australia-India relationship has gone on for a long time, but it's really only since the election of Tony Abbott in 2013 in Australia that it's developed a strategic flavour. Prime Ministers Rudd and Gillard, former Australian Prime Ministers, have both made trips to Delhi and had outreach to Delhi, but it's really only since Abbott's come to the leadership in Australia that the relationship has developed. Abbott has taken a trip to India at the end of last year, and Modi was also here for the G20 summit. So it's these sort of events have really provided a great opportunity to develop the bilateral relationship, and it's really just been a stage to show the warmth that exists between Prime Ministers Abbott and Modi. The most significant development really in the relationship in the last few years has been the signing of the framework for security cooperation between the two nations. It's been the most substantive development. It brought out annual executive and ministerial meetings. We've established regular maritime exercises and joint military training. There's defense technology sharing and a whole range of other cooperation on other matters that are important to both countries. So it was a deepening of the relationship that we have with India, and really signaled a new era of values-based cooperation between the two countries.
Dushan, I just wanted to ask you quickly, it seems to me that there's a lot of developments happening in bilateral relationships and multilateral sort of groupings, but what are some of the challenges when it comes to engaging with India? What are the challenges in deepening that engagement?
I think there is still, we're still very conscious about our non-alignment movement, where we don't want to be seen as, you know, aligning or grouping, you know, with other countries and other powers, where it could be seen as like, you know, okay, this grouping is aimed at so-and-so, or, you know, this grouping, and then India is a part of it. We have maintained that for so long that it's going to take a while for us to separate that from what is required right now, that, you know, to say that engaging with these countries at a multilateral level does not mean that we are, it's an alliance against something, or it's an alliance towards something. It's just what is required right now in the region. I think that's where we are struggling a bit between the two, where India is trying to maintain and hold on to its, to the role that it has played in the past about the non-alignment and what it is. But of course, there is a change. There has been a change. It is going to take a while. The signing of the Indo-US joint statement was a big step away from that, from the non-aligned perception that India has had. And other than that, also, I feel that the challenges is in within the political bureaucracy here itself, where to come to, there are different views and thoughts, and where there is a section who's very cautious and is very cautious about the steps that India takes next in terms of not agitating China too much, because we have the issue of Pakistan, we have a border issues on Arunachal, and there is that cautious, and there's this other section who feels that, you know, if India does not do enough now, then we are just going to lose our credibility as a regional security actor. So, you know, merging these, all of this together and coming to a point, balancing this is what I think is being a problem. But there's definitely been a change since the Narendra Modi government has come in. And it is a good change that has been welcomed by everyone. But having said so, I would still say that it is going to take a while, a bit of time, till we can actually come tall on the expectations that the region has from us.
I see. David, I would just like to just help expand a little bit about India's growing relationships and you know, its shift in its non-alignment position. You recently spent some time in Japan, and I was hoping you might unpack a little bit of a few of the developments that have happened in the India-Japan relationship, because that seems to me what Joshana was talking about earlier, about a region full of, you know, powers that are growing, and it seems like Japan actually has an important role to play.
Yeah, that's right. And a lot of the energy that's come into the India-Japan relationship since Modi came to power particularly comes from the executive level. Prime Minister Abe is a well-known fan of India. In his first term, he really, it was only a short term for 1 year, but he really pushed, as one of his pet foreign policy projects, engagement with India. We saw him sign a strategic partnership with Prime Minister Singh, and he also delivered what is quite a frequently referenced speech to the Indian Parliament on the confluence of the two seas, where Abe really laid out his vision for rules and norms in the Asia-Pacific, in the Pacific Ocean and the Indian Ocean meeting. He really drew that link between Japan and India. And if you look at a map and you draw an arc between Tokyo and Delhi, then that goes right over the top of Beijing. So it's quite clear what Abe was on about in his first term. And so when he's come back to power this time around, it really seems like he's back in power in Japan, and he's keen to finish what he started with India. And with Modi, he sees a lot of alignment. They're both conservative, nationalist, pro-business leaders. They both came to power pledging to rejuvenate their economies and restore national pride. So they see a lot of similarities, and the background of that really is a growing alignment of interests, values and concerns between the two countries, and it's all related to China's rise.
Dashana, can I ask you briefly, how is the India-Japan relationship and how is Prime Minister Abe viewed in New Delhi?
I think the India-Japan relationship is going quite well, and Abe is viewed in a very positive light here. What's happening? India has we have expressed that we want to engage with Japan, and even with in terms of even investments economically in India, we had invited Japan to invest in the Northeast, where China is not really allowed to invest much because of the issue with Arunachal Pradesh, and in the With Japan, but I think here, what the strategic community here wants to also see is some sort of a more engagement at bilateral level with Japan, and that's what Japan sees too. And we feel that there has been enough from Japan's side welcoming India, but India has probably not done as much as is expected. Like David's mentioned, Narendra Modi has really taken on the task of actually going back, and he said Narendra Modi did come to power saying those things, and then to restore national pride. So we were a maritime nation at one point of time, and I think Modi does want to see that we do get back to it, and it is going, but I still feel that there is some sort of a bit of a disappointment as far as India's relationship with East Asia is concerned. Although the locus has been turned into axis, there is still an image somewhere that India is not very serious about its axis policy. But that's also because India is not as actively engaged in the South China Sea disputes or the East China Sea disputes as I guess our ASEAN friends would expect us to be. But at the same time, it should be noted that we don't have any direct claims in the South China Sea or in that area. Our interest in that area is our relationship with East Asian countries and our economic activities with Vietnam, which we are holding strong. So I guess these are the things that are trying to balance each other out.
That's interesting. I'd like to come back to India, Southeast Asia in a second. But I note that the India-Japan relationship is something that several actors like the United States and Australia would like to develop more. Dave, I was hoping that you might allude to a little bit more about that bilateral relationship. Are there any challenges in that further development?
Sorry, can you ask that again?
Absolutely.
Is this between
Japan and India?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Look, I think there's not really many challenges between Japan and India. Their relations have typically been warm and strong. There's no historical baggage to speak of between the two. And they're getting closer together thanks to China's rise and the historical tensions and territorial disputes that both maintain with China. The only exception to this really is on nuclear cooperation. Civil nuclear cooperation has remained out of reach of Japan-India relations despite a lot of effort over many years from both sides. They've not been able to close a deal. And so while there's real vigor and energy in the relationship from the executive level, and it's starting to filter through, there are still sensitivities with technology sharing and with the bureaucracies that need to be overcome in both Tokyo and in Delhi.
All right. Darshana, I just wanted to now move the discussion to expanding that to the trilateral. We've talked about this concept before, David and I anyway, this Japan-India-Australia trilateral. What are your thoughts on the development of that? Is that a useful concept for security in the Indian Ocean?
Yes, I definitely think so. I mean, we had our first foreign secretary level trilateral between Japan and Australia, and I think at the end of the meeting, the statement also said that, you know, Japan, Australia, and India are on the same page as far as security and security in the in both Asia Pacific and the Indian Ocean region is concerned. And I think for India, from looking just from the Indian angle, also a collaboration with Japan and Australia would be a really strong collaboration, because, you know, we cover a large area, and then if we can actually materialize a trilateral between even if you leave US out and if it's just Japan and Australia as a trilateral, I think that solves Indian strategic interests, where we are going out and we are engaging with like-minded actors or powers and doing exercises, training, cooperation, collaboration in terms of areas that are of common to all the three countries. So I think, yes, it is definitely a very good development, and it's welcomed, and we look forward to more. I think even if you talk about the strategic community back in New Delhi, everybody is really hopeful about this, and especially in the light of the rise of China, and, you know, as far as India playing a bigger role in the region. So it definitely is a good one.
David, I see you nodding furiously. I just wanted to see if you wanted to add anything to this, because you've written a paper on this recently.
Yeah, look, all three leaders and are really leading the nations, and they want to do more in the regional security space. They're all looking for opportunities to contribute because they see the challenge that China poses and the synergy that exists between the three countries. It was interesting to note this week that Vice President Joe Biden has spoken of the India-Japan-US trilateral, and that's been going on since, I think, about 2011, but it's one that he's now flagged will be upgraded to the ministerial level from the senior official level. And that could be considered to be a bit of an indication on where we might see the Australia-Japan-India trilateral develop. And it's certainly something that I recommended in my paper, that we really need to invest with ministerial level representation between these three countries, because at the end of the day, hierarchy is most important in Asia Pacific. If this trilateral between Australia, Japan and India is to have legs, then it really needs buy-in from senior leaders from the three countries.
And I'd like to actually take that in and apply it to a specific context. My final thing I'd like for the three of us to discuss today, Dashana, what are your thoughts on the role that India, Australia and Japan can play in that vexatious area that we call the South China Sea?
Right. Neither Australia nor India has, like I've just mentioned, we don't have any direct claims in the South China Sea. So, and I think both nations have, to a certain extent, maintained a distance from the issue as far as, you know, international condemning the issue and everything is concerned. But as countries with interest in maintaining regional peace and security, we both India and Australia perhaps can increase its presence a little bit more, like, and especially if this trilateral comes through of Japan, India, and Australia. Because South China Sea is in natural waters, and a lot of Indian trade does transit through that area, and we have economic cooperation with Vietnam, where we've run into trouble with China because of the overlapping claims, where China's also asked us and warned us, in fact, to pull out of these in investing in these oil blocks. And I think it is important to be present in that area and to show that we are here to reinstate the rules of the law, and that, you know, we will uphold. And if there are three middle powers, with three equally important powers coming out there and imposing the same rules and upholding the norms, and then it's going to be difficult for China to kind of take unilateral action, as opposed to just being India versus as opposed to being China versus US. China is doing something, and we are expecting US to, you know, say something or do something in terms of retaliation. And if we can probably just go a bit more, maybe not so much, but maybe a bit more between Australia, India, and Japan, and just increase a little bit of a presence in the South China Sea, I think the situation can be managed much more, because we all do have interest in that area. It's an important trading route. So just by doing some exercises, I guess, just to show that we do uphold international rules and norms, I think that's enough for now.
David, any additional thoughts?
Yeah, I think that's a really good rundown, Dashana. Together, I'm not sure how much of a role they can play right now in the South China Sea, and really looking at the pace of development in the South China Sea, now is the time that we do need to be doing things together. But we're only in early days of talking about trilateral maritime exercises between the three. I mean, the senior foreign affairs officials who attended the meeting in Delhi last month were quite reticent in terms of not wanting to come out and say that we will have maritime activities. It's more that the reporting indicated that there might be activities. So we haven't really got the trilateral maritime exercise dimension of our relationship going yet. But I think beyond the South China Sea, there's huge scope to develop a military-to-military maritime agenda between the three nations. They're all large maritime democracies, after all, and so a maritime focus is really... it seems to be a good fit for the three. When I was writing my paper, I looked at the maritime interests of Japan and Australia. It's very clear where they overlap, just as it's very clear where the maritime interests of India and Australia overlap. But in order to really get this trilateral going in the maritime space, you need to understand where the maritime interests of Japan and India intersect. And so in order to shine a light on this uncertainty, I think the initial focus could be on developing a theater-wide operating picture through anti-submarine warfare activities and sharing situational intelligence. Once you've got that bedded down in the first year, then you can develop a sustainable and useful maritime agenda between the three countries. And from that point, you can start to act in other theatres like the South China Sea, which might be a little more hotly contested and controversial in the capitals.
All right, well, I guess we'll have to see where these developments pan out. Darshana and David, thank you both for spending your time with us today.
Thanks, Nat.
Thank you.
And to all our listeners, thanks very much for joining us again. Don't forget, you can catch all of our previous podcasts at simsec.org, or you can find them on iTunes. Don't forget to leave us a 5-star rating, and join us again for another SimSec Sea Control episode again in future. Bye-bye.